Thank you for joining us. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affair Hour, and I'm Tammy Bang Liu with my co-host here, Damon Azali. As the unchecked military power of the United States is projected across the globe, specifically with Afghanistan and Iraq, the confluence between gender depression, sexual violence, and military aggression grows daily. Joining us to discuss her own interventions on this issue is Linda Burnham, co-founder of the Women of Color Resource Center in Oakland, where she currently serves as executive director, and is also part of the War Times Collective. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. So your recent articles in El Templo de Guerreras, Sexual Domination in Uniform and American Value, is a great intervention in what you've termed basically the tangled strands of racism, misogyny, homophobia, national arrogance, and hypermasculinity that characterizes the U.S. military. Militarized sexual domination is neither contrary to American values nor simply the work of a few bad apples. It is rather a daily practice. And that was the opening sentence of your article. Could you explain a little more?
Yeah, well, you know, the article was written because I, like everyone else, was outraged by what the photographs of Abu Ghraib revealed. And I, like everybody else, really struggled for a response, for understanding and for response. Understanding what was going on, what was being revealed, and what were adequate responses to it. And in sitting and thinking about it and thinking about how disturbing those images were, and thinking about how disturbing the reality behind those images was, I sort of fell back on work that we had done here at the Women of Color Resource Center through a gender analysis working group. We put together a gender analysis working group soon after 9/11, and we put it together because we felt that it was unlikely that the gender ramifications of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq would be taken up adequately by the anti-war movement and by progressives unless we did some thinking about it and put out some ideas about it. And so even early on, in the months following 9/11, we put together a postcard that said 10 reasons why women should oppose the U.S. war on terrorism. And the idea here is that there's nothing that takes place in our society that doesn't have a gender dimension. It may be a gender dimension that is not raised to the surface. It may be a gender dimension that is not recognized. But pretty much every major social dynamic and institution has some gendered dynamic going on within it. And so in looking at those photographs at Abu Ghraib, of Abu Ghraib, which I'm sure will be analyzed for years and years to come from many, many different angles, that phenomena, I really felt it was important to raise up issues of sexual domination because the conversation that was coming out of the administration and essentially the line of the administration that the administration was trying to convince the U.S. public of was that Abu Ghraib represented a deviation. Abu Ghraib represented aberration, and that it was the work of what they called a few bad apples. And if those few bad apples could be identified and punished, then the problem would be solved. And I, from the work that I'd done with the gender analysis group and from reading, knew right from the top that it was not a question of a few bad apples, but a question of military policy, a question of foreign policy, and that gender issues are profoundly integrated as a subtext or a text in U.S. foreign policy. So that's the reason I wrote the article.
No, I mean, we totally, at the Strategy Center, also understand that the interdependence of class exploitation, exploitation of nations and peoples, and the subjugation of women under imperialism are not distinct systems of just patriarchy, capitalism, and colonial exploitation, but actually very importantly linked in a world system which we call U.S. imperialism or imperialism.
Yeah, great. So it's good that there are, that was a mouthful, and it's really good that there are organizations out there that have that understanding and that put that out in the work that they do. But it's not generally recognized. But I did, I mean, I have to say that getting this article out there resonated with a lot of people. I mean, I got a lot of positive responses, as well as some response from military men who were not happy,
particularly
with what was said.
Right. I remember, well, I want to actually ask you, there was the first time I actually met you was at a BRC meeting in Oakland.
The Black Radical Congress.
The Black Radical Congress, and it was a hall-day meeting, and at the end was, like, I think the first time that you actually spoke, and I'll be interested for you to talk about the 10 reasons why women should not fight in the war, not support the war. But one that really stuck out for me was when you were talking about how the U.S. kind of twists its use of patriarchy and how it explains it, and that U.S. posing itself as a liberator of women's rights, particularly, and at that time it was around Afghanistan, you know,
right.
We're going in, the U.S. is going in, and we're saving women, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Meanwhile, you know, here people, you know, the right to choose is threatened. I read an article the other day about people being sterilized in different third world countries that we had relationship to, et cetera, et cetera. So what are some of the other, you know, two or three top things that aren't necessarily on the conscience of even, you know, progressive and leftists that you think are important to actually put out there?
Well, I want to just speak for just a moment about the one that you mentioned, which is how feminism is used to justify national oppression. So I felt that that was a very interesting dynamic in the early stages just after 9/11, wherein the U.S. public had pretty much heard nothing about the women of Afghanistan, heard nothing and knew little from our government about the women of Afghanistan, knew nothing about our country's policy in Afghanistan. But in the run-up to war there, one of the ways in which support for that war was rallied was by invoking the status and situation of Afghan women. So I'm not saying that the status and condition of Afghan women is not a subject of conversation, but when that it becomes a subject of conversation, when it gets put on the table, in the interest of rallying the broadest segment of the population behind a war agenda, which was, in fact, the intent in those days after 9/11, then we've got a very interesting confluence going on where the feminist sentiments of women are being invoked in order to undergird an agenda of national domination, basically. And feminism that is not informed by awareness of what the U.S. Role is around the world, that is not informed by anti-racist politic, and that's not informed by a politic that understands how class relations operate in the U.S. and around the world, that kind of narrow feminism is subject to being manipulated in precisely that way. And one of the things that happened after 9/11, I was really kind of appalled. I spoke to a woman who was one of the founders of Women's Strike for Peace, which is an early peace organization. You know, probably began maybe in the 1960s. One of your listeners might know more about the history and dates of Women's Strike for Peace, but a very prominent organization. I was speaking with one of the founders, and she was supportive of the war, and she was supportive of it precisely on the grounds that it had the potential to liberate, quote-unquote, Afghan women. So, you know, so that's one of the 10 reasons why we felt that women should oppose the U.S. War, so-called war on terrorism, that the Pentagon cannot liberate Afghan women or any other women. And our expectation should not be that was the case. Another reason why women should oppose the U.S. war on terrorism that we identified was that U.S. war industries, and, you know, we know the names of many of them now, the same industries that have created the criminal industrial complex here in the United States, many of them, that these war industries reap enormous profits, while programs that benefit women and girls, such as health care, education, welfare, and child care, face budget cuts. That's another reason. another is that women's human rights and civil liberties are endangered in war zones.
Linda, do you have any of these on your website?
Oh, absolutely. Our website is www.coloredgirls.org. So this postcard is available. You can order it on the website. You can also download the 10 reasons from the website.
Okay. You know, maybe we should also move into what we can do here in the U.S. I mean, you've been a part of the Women of Color, Third World Women's Alliance, and then the Women of Color Resource Center on the front lines of trying to open up this debate inside the U.S. In terms of looking ahead to November, what are things that the Women of Color Resource Center and yourself are working on in terms of putting out demands for the November elections and putting out demands that will begin to be addressed in terms of looking at how we can open up the dialogue of real liberation for women and particularly working class women of color?
Yeah. Before we move to that, I wanted to just spend a moment or two talking about why I felt it was important to raise up the notion of sexual domination as a daily practice within the military and not an aberration. I feel like it's important to sort of underscore this because many of us don't really pay careful attention to how the U.S. military operates overseas, even when we're not conducting a hot war, and what are some of the gender dynamics within the U.S. military domestically and here at home on U.S. military bases. So just 2 points in relationship to that. One, sexual domination goes along with the national domination in the many countries in which we have military bases. Mm-hmm. Part of that is related to issues of prostitution that's linked to the presence of military bases. And the fact that rest and relaxation, as conceptualized within our U.S. military, is dependent upon the sexual subjugation of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of women in the Philippines, in Thailand, in Kenya, at bases around the world. Mm-hmm. So that at those bases, or surrounding those bases, are sexual trafficking, the bars and houses of prostitution that service the servicemen, and poor women from villages all over the world are trafficked or themselves come to work in bars and end up being prostitutes for these servicemen. And this is a part of the understanding, essentially, between the U.S. Military and the governments with which they have treaty agreements around the positioning of these military bases. So, I feel like it is completely disingenuous to pretend that sexual dynamic is not part of the way our U.S. military operates. Another way that I feel like is important that your listeners understand, and this relates to series that appeared in the Denver Post not very long ago, but that spoke to the issues having to do with rape, sexual assault, and sexual harassment within the U.S. military of service women, right? Of service women and of the wives, partners, and lovers of U.S. service men. This is a profound problem within the military, and it occurs at a rate, the rate of sexual assault and harassment and rape within our society as a whole is fairly outrageous.
And is underreported.
And is underreported, very much so. But within the military, it's even higher. Mm. So there was a recent survey, for example, that showed that 30% of female veterans reported a rape or an attempted rape during their period of active duty.
Yeah.
That three-fourths of, speaking of underreporting, that three-fourths of female veterans who were raped did not, in fact, report the incident.
Mm.
They either didn't know how to report the incident or felt like reporting it would jeopardize their own status or bring more grief upon themselves than they already had. So these are, and if your listeners are interested in finding out more about this, there's a foundation called the Miles Foundation that develops statistics and factual information on sexual assault and domestic abuse and rape within the military.
And is that Miles, M-I-L-E-S?
M-I-L-E-S, and they can be found at hometown.aol.com /MILESFDN, Miles Foundation.
Can you do that one more time?
Yep. hometown.aol.com /MILESFDN. So that's one source to find out. Another source is to just go to the Denver Post's website, and www.denverpost.com, and read this series. The series is called Betrayal in the Ranks, and it is story after story after story of the ways in which women who are part of the military both had to deal with the rape or sexual assault at the hand of the perpetrator, but then also had to turn around and face the ways in which the military structures, either denied their claims, suppressed their claims, disregarded them, re-victimized them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Linda, I have a quick question. Do you have any resources around trafficking?
There are resources around trafficking, and I would also suggest that your listeners be in touch with an organization called Gabriela. I don't know Gabriela's website, but you could go up on Google or one of the other search engines and find them. They're an organization that is active both in the Philippines and the U.S. and is active around issues of sexual trafficking and around issues of prostitution. There's a lot of work going on, as a matter of fact, amongst women's organizations that work with prostitutes in Korea, in the Philippines, et cetera. So there's a considerable amount of information on that work that could be found at any one of the major search engines.
Okay. Linda, we have a couple more minutes. So going back to in terms of the November elections, and the reason I ask the question is, you know, you've been to the many United Nations World Conference on Women,
mm-hmm.
where women from around the world place demands on what it would actually look like to allow them an opportunity to breathe, to allow them an opportunity to be able to push back against the daily just oppressive and exploitive nature of the various systems that they're under. And so in terms of thinking about the November elections, and, you know, obviously it's a central question of what are we going to do about Bush, but also what demands are we going to put on Kerry? In terms of an actual platform for women's liberation.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, there are a number of things to look at here. One is, obviously people from around the world would like to be able to participate in our election, if only they could. Everyone, you know, with a minimal amount of consciousness around the world is looking at this election as a referendum on the policies of the last several years and understands the incredible what is at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And pardon me?
I think we just had a little bit of static. Keep going.
Okay. So I feel like our capacity to really mobilize ourselves in relationship to the election, in relationship to voter education, get out the vote, and protect the vote efforts, that is, figuring out how to make sure that we do the work to monitor the polls to the extent possible. I feel like that's one piece of the work, and everyone who has not yet figured out how to hook into one of those processes really needs to do so. So I really encourage your listening audience to think about how, between now and the end of October, how to do get out the vote work, how to do voter registration work, how to do protect the vote, monitor the vote work, because it is an incredibly important election. And I feel like so that's one side. The other side is clearly neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party is represented. Well, the Democratic Party, let's put it this way, does not represent and has not spoken to a sharp break with the policies being promoted by Bush. In the event that Kerry is elected, it's clear that on issues of women's liberation, on issues of foreign policy, on issues having to do with communities of color and education, et cetera, we will have to be as vigilant on November 3rd as we, you know, our work will not end on November 3rd, regardless of who's in the White House.
Well, I want to thank Linda Burnham for joining us. Linda, do you want to give out your phone number really quick so people can get in?
Yeah, if you're interested in contacting the Women of Color Resource Center, you can contact us either at info@coloredgirls.org or at 510-444-2700 or visit our website at www.coloredgirls.org.
Again, that was 510-444-2700 and www.coloredgirls.org. Again, thanks so much, Linda Burnham.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And we'll be right back with two members from Coalition for Educational Justice talking about something that's happening tomorrow that you guys should come out to at the LAUSD board.
We'll be right back.